This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we'll begin today with Governor Charlie Baker's announcement that the closure of non-essential businesses and the stay-at-home advisory are extended until May 18th.
We're all incredibly eager to move on from this phase of our lives, but if we act too soon, we could risk a spike in infections that could force our state to revert to serious restrictions again. And this scenario would be far worse for our economy and for our communities and for our people.
WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown was there and joins us now from our State House Bureau. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, what struck you today from the governor's announcement on this extension? It didn't really seem in the last few days from hearing him that there was any way we were going to hit the original May 4th date.
Yeah, he's been saying for a long time that we need 2 solid weeks of downward trend for hospitalizations and some other factors. We simply ran out of calendar, so he really had no choice but to kick it out 2 weeks. So that resets the clock with 20 days now. Let's see if the key figures that he keeps an eye on go down. If they do, that'll be great. Then you can start looking at places where you can reopen, where you can get things going, or some areas where you may have to wait. He's always said that when we reopen, it's not just going to be flicking the switch and everybody goes back. They're going to have to be doing this in a phased-in manner.
Steve, you're at the briefings every day, and I cover them. Over the last few days, there's been a lot of pushback from the press about the governor waiting so long to make a statement that seemed to be inevitable. What was the governor's explanation?
Yeah, his explanation was that the rate of hospitalizations has just stagnated, and they're still too high. And that number has stayed that way for about 13 days. It has got to come down. I think he has been hoping that it would have come down a little bit sooner. We would look at those numbers every day that they'd come out from DPH, hoping, you know, for some sign of a downward trend, and we just hadn't seen it. Just plateaued, was flat, and going forward, and because of that, there was just no way that he was going to make any changes.
So the governor also named a 17-member advisory board for reopening. Can you tell us about why he did that and what he expects from this board?
Yeah, he expects them to be meeting every day pretty much over the next 20 days to put together some sort of a plan of how we're going to emerge from this. As I just said, we're not going to just flick the switch and say, okay, everybody, go back to work. They're going to plan it out and figure out the best way to do it so that we can get the economy going again, but at the same time, not create a situation where we're going to all of a sudden boost infections and maybe have a second wave of COVID-19 infections.
So, Steve, my understanding is they're actually having their first Zoom meeting right now. Who is on that task force, and who's maybe missing that maybe should be there?
Sure. It's made up of 17 members, which is actually kind of small for a task force. They purposefully did that because they got a lot of work to do between now and the 18th. That's when this report is due. So they want to get them to work. If you get a big group like that, sometimes it takes a long time. There's a lot of high-tech folks on this. I'm just looking. A lot of people from the healthcare industry. There's some municipal leaders. Dan Rivera, the mayor of Lawrence, is on this. Also, the mayor of East Hampton is on it. And Mayor Marty Walsh's chief of staff is on this. Some folks from manufacturing. I'm surprised I'm not seeing a lot more retailers. The only retailer on this is the owner of a bookstore on Nantucket, of all places. That's the only retailer I'm seeing on that. So I'm kind of surprised about that. I thought that they might have some folks from the legislature on this. And I also thought, you know, again, maybe some of the bigger groups, Associated Industries of Massachusetts or the Massachusetts Retailers Association. I thought they would have a representative from those organizations on here. Instead, they're just going to the actual people that are the CEOs and the heads of the various companies that they've selected.
So in just a couple minutes, we'll be speaking here on Radio Boston with the head of the Massachusetts Retailers Association. I'll be interested in his comments. Steve, before I let you go, it doesn't really seem, if the report from this group is due by on May 18th, it doesn't really seem that the economy will magically open then. So what is the implication of a rollout that comes after that, and how likely is it the most non-essential businesses will be closed beyond mid-May.
Well, again, it all depends on how they can do it in terms of, you know, which businesses can they reopen and have little impact on creating more infections. So those will get the green light first. Some of the other ones, I think, you know, anything where you're going to have a lot of people gathering together, those are going to have to hold off for a while. It's going to be phased in, and it's going to take a little while.
That is WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thanks, Tiziana.
And as I just mentioned, joining us now for Reaction is John Hurst. He is the president of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts. They're a statewide trade association with 4,000 members. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, how are you doing? Thank you for having me.
I'm well, thanks, and I'm glad to have you. What was your reaction to the extension today?
Well, it wasn't a surprise. We anticipated, just like just about everybody did. What we were hoping for, I'll be perfectly honest with you, was a little more freeing up of what mom-and-pop retailers can do in the state. We have And we're going to be making that clear to the task force. We have determined that Massachusetts is an outlier when it comes to small businesses, small retailers actually fulfilling orders from their customers. From a lock store, just the ability to take an internet order, a phone order, an email order, and ship out of that closed store. You know, whether it be flowers for Mother's Day or jewelry or clothing.
John, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Are you saying that we're more restrictive here in the Commonwealth and that fewer retailers are able to do that kind of thing?
We are the most restrictive state in the country when it comes to small businesses being able to actually sell their inventory, you know, from behind locked doors. No other state is as strict as Massachusetts, not even New York, not any other New England state. So we need to have some relaxation of that to allow these small businesses a chance to sell their inventory and reconnect with their customers.
How has that impacted your members, John?
Well, it's been troubling. You know, the first 3 weeks you think you can just tread water and get by, and then 3 weeks quickly turned into 7 weeks, and now 7 weeks are looking at 9 weeks. We have 4,000 members. We've had some that have done all right. We have grocers. We have pharmacies. We have hardware stores. Some have done better than others and are so-called essential. We have some restaurants that have transitioned to curbside. But these others, these non-essentials that, you know, that sell, whether it be clothing or jewelry or furniture, you know, some more durable goods. They actually are either they're not selling anything, or frankly, they are ignoring the governor's order. It's troubling because they have all the online big competition that is shipping all this material in out of state and right to someone's doorsteps. And so the small businesses need to have the very same latitude, whether they're selling books, Mother's Day flowers, jewelry, clothing, and the like.
John, I hope that this doesn't sound like a crass question. I don't mean it to. But is there a date out there on the horizon where your 4,000 members just can't make it if reopening doesn't happen before then?
Well, you know, it all depends on the company. You know, how much of a reserves did you have? And how successful were you with the PPP? 92% of our members have applied for the PPP, and here's the real rub on that.
That's the Small Business Relief Fund, right?
Yeah, the Paycheck Protection Program out of the SBA, and here's the problem with that here in Massachusetts. If you are 100% closed and you have no sales, you have no payroll, right? If you have no payroll under that PPP, that money that you get from the SBA, you must pay back. It becomes a loan, not a grant. Now, if you're a law firm or a insurance agent or whatever working out of your home, your payroll really hasn't changed, right? But if you're a small mom-and-pop jeweler and you're closed and you have no income coming in, you don't have payroll. And that requirement, you know, you have to spend 75% of that money, the PPP money, on payroll. So you have the federal requirements on spending on payroll, and then you have the state requirements that says that you must be closed and you cannot serve your customer. And that is pushing a lot of these small businesses to the edge, as you talk about, of perhaps not being able to survive, because the last thing they need, the last thing they want is another loan. They needed a grant to get them through this crisis that was not of their making.
That sounds incredibly challenging. What's your communication with the governor on this, and what would you like to see come out of this advisory group that's working on the report for May 18th?
Well, the first thing we want to do is to make it clear that these small businesses can indeed fulfill orders from a locked store and serve their customers, whether it's delivery, shipping, or even a curbside. Most states, all the northeastern states from New York through Maine, have now instituted curbside, just like we have for our restaurants. Allow them to sell without any face-to-face contact with customers some goods. We need to do that now, like this week.
For May 18th, were you surprised? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And for May 18th, we need to learn from what we learned from our hardware stores, our grocers, our pharmacies. You know, we instituted percentage of occupancy standards. Like for grocery stores, it's 40% occupancy. We have hand sanitizers, washing hand and or hand washing facilities. We have requirements for staff, and a lot of communities have requirements for consumers on face coverings. We have to really apply what we learned for the essential businesses to the non-essential, and probably limit the number of people that come into the store at any given time. Maybe in some cases it's by appointment only. But we need to step by step start reopening the economy, because look, the consumer is 70% of the economy, and we've told the consumer that they shouldn't be spending. And if they're not spending, they're not spending with these small businesses. They're not generating any tax revenue for our cities and towns and our state government. We need them to begin step by step to feel more comfortable health-wise that they can safely spend money for themselves and their families and their loved ones. And they can do that by also investing in their communities and their main streets.
That's John Hurst. He's the president of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts. John, I really appreciate you being with us today, and we'll be thinking about your members over these next couple weeks as the report unfolds.
Thank you very much.
Some cities and towns are hit harder by the coronavirus than others. And in Massachusetts, the hardest hit right now is Chelsea, which is seeing the highest rate of infection in the state. So for the rest of the hour, we want to take a look at what's happening there and why. We'll hear from city and community leaders and a researcher as we take a look at what has made Chelsea so vulnerable and how the community is responding. We want you to join the conversation. Do you live in Chelsea or another community that's been hit disproportionately? What are things like for you right now? And if you don't live in Chelsea or another hard-hit area, what do you make of what's going on there and how the community is responding? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We have three guests for this conversation. Joining us on the line is Tom Ambrosino, City Manager of Chelsea. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Gladys Vega, Executive Director of the Chelsea Collaborative. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for inviting us.
And Catherine Robb, postdoctoral research fellow with the Bloomberg Harvard City Leadership Initiative at the Harvard Kennedy School. She studied housing and health conditions in Chelsea. Thanks for being with us, Catherine.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Tom and Gladys, I want to start with you. How are you both, and how is your community right now?
Tom, you want to go ahead?
I would say the community is suffering significantly from the impacts of COVID-19, both health-wise, as you mentioned, we have the highest rates of infection in the state, and so lots of people are suffering. We've had a lot of deaths here in Chelsea, and we are suffering economically. Lots of people out of work, many with zero income coming in, and no prospects of getting any federal relief, whether that's a stimulus check, because these people do not have Social Security numbers or didn't pay taxes, and many worked under the table, so they have no prospects of getting unemployment compensation. So lots of families with zero income coming in, and with the economy shut down, no chance of getting any income in the next few weeks, and so many are in very desperate straits.
Gladys, what Tom just said is devastating. What is life like every day in the midst of this crisis for people?
So for us, it's life is, right now we have no life. We work 16 hours a day. We're running around placing people in hotels, trying to figure out where they're going to sleep next day, figuring out what they're going to have for dinner, trying to identify people that are in food lines that are COVID-19, asking them, please, if you're COVID-19, you should not be in this food line. You should be home. Can I get your phone number? It is so hard also to maintain confidentiality among people that are outside waiting to get some type of relief or resources because they don't know any better and they have no one at home that can do those errands for them, such as picking up diapers out of diaper line or picking up food. And they have a very limited amount of resources. They don't have no savings. I think that it has hit us so hard just because the demographics of our city. We are so crowded in terms of our apartments, and people live with other family members in a home. So the spread was, for us, it wasn't, for me, it was not a surprise that our numbers rise so fast in terms of the cases that we have. I actually,
let's dig it.
You know, when people
go
said,
ahead.
I can't believe it, I'm like, no, I believe it. I would expect less.
Let's dig into that a little bit. Dr. Joseph Betancourt, who's the Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer at Massachusetts General Hospital, told us that he thinks that Chelsea is not the only community in the country facing this unique set of challenges. Here he is.
Chelsea has a series of kind of what I call social conditions, not unlike areas in New Orleans, not unlike areas in Queens, New York, not unlike areas in Detroit, where these have impacted both Black and Latino people.
And Gladys, you talked about one of those social conditions, which is the housing situation. I want to turn to Catherine on that. Catherine, you spent a summer researching how housing and health conditions in Chelsea are impacting the community. What did you find, and how does it relate to what's happening in Chelsea now?
Yeah, so housing is so much more than physical shelter. It impacts so many aspects of our lives, including our health, in really powerful ways. And so, for example, housing-related risks in the home can stem from things like insect infestations causing asthma attacks, or social aspects such as overcrowded conditions straining interpersonal relationships and contributing to abuse or mental health problems. And right now, people are spending more time than ever inside their homes. And for many people in Chelsea, home is not a safe place to be. It not only can increase, is associated with increased risks of coronavirus transmission due to limited control over hygiene or social distancing within the home. But even before the pandemic, homes for many residents weren't a safe place to be.
I want to grab a call on this, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We have Virgin on the line from State Street. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking the call. I'm an attorney in Boston, and, you know, 90% of my clients live in Chelsea, Lynn, and they're Latinos, let's put it that way. And I can tell you that over the years, what I have seen is the incredible inequity in housing that causes people to not just live three families to one bedroom in a three-bedroom apartment house, you know, but also to take the living room and divide that up by putting a wall up to accommodate more people to live in there, just so that they can afford a rent that's anywhere between $2,500 to $3,000 for sometimes a two-bedroom apartment, which is unconscionable in many ways. And the gentrification that has taken place in some of these communities, particularly East Boston and Chelsea is driving that inequity. And, you know, you see it in family court where there are issues regarding custody of children and rotating children around these houses. You see it in housing court where if you were to check the dockets from Suffolk County alone, which includes Chelsea and East Boston, it's just incredible, you know. And housing, from my point of view, housing should be an unalienable right. It should be something that you should be able to afford where to live if you work. And notwithstanding that some of these...
So thank you for that, Virgin. I'm gonna take it back from you there and come back to our panelists, specifically Tom and Gladys. And I want to put the housing conversation in context, because one thing that we've been learning consistently over the last several weeks, and we must understand, is that if a community is disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus, then it's been disproportionately impacted by public policy before the coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, so this is Tom. I mean, I think that's true. I think when you're looking at communities that have these very high rates of infection, whether they're in Massachusetts or around the nation, it's typically communities that share the following characteristics. They have crowded housing stock. They have a lot of low-wage workers who go to work on crowded public transportation and work in crowded facilities like grocery stores or food manufacturing plants or in hospitals as orderlies. And so every aspect of their life is in a situation where a virus like this is going to spread. When they're home, they're in a crowded unit. When they're going to work, they're in a crowded subway or bus line. And when they're at work, they're in a crowded location. So it's sort of a perfect storm, and it's why cities and towns that share those characteristics are the ones at the top of the list when it comes to infection rates from this virus.
Gladys, yeah, I heard you agreeing.
Yes. We believe that 80% of our residents are sort of like the essential employees that work in the hotel industry in Logan Airport. They go to Boston, clean offices, and do whatever they need to do in order for them to put food at the table. 50% of our residents cannot afford stable, unsubsidized housing. So they have to rent these rooms. When we are in the food line, we're asking people, we do a wellness check. We don't care about where they live or we don't ask for name, but we just say, hey, can you tell me a little bit about what's your housing situation like? Has anyone been sick and stuff? And they basically, families every day tell us how drastically they've been impacted by this pandemic. They feel that when this is over, this experience will leave our low-income community completely in a disadvantage and inequality that many of them were already facing, which will bring drastically problems because they don't believe that they will go back to their jobs. They feel that the housing is real bad, but it will only be worse because many of them, bodegas that they used to work, or many of the stores that they used to work, will no longer be in business. So the fear of not having a job when this is over makes it much worse.
I want to bring in another voice here. A couple of weeks ago, Radio Boston spoke to Jose Martinez, an essential worker in the pandemic. Jose Martinez is a custodian at Boston University, commutes every day from Chelsea. Here is what he had to say.
On top of going to work and putting yourself on the line like that, I travel on the T. My day starts about 4:30 in the morning. And when I get on the bus, it's all essential personnel. And you see it in people's eyes, that nervousness, you know, that fear. Who's next?
So when we had Jose Martinez on, we were talking about essential workers. And that is one whole category of people who are at risk and then often compounded by the type of transportation that's available, the communities they live in, that population density, price of housing, et cetera. We also heard from a lot of people that day who are out of work and are going to face the challenges that you're talking about, Gladys. Catherine, as we put all of this together, what are the systems level issues that we need to be addressing as we work our way through this pandemic?
Yeah, so I think Chelsea is really emblematic of this affordable housing crisis that many cities are facing with skyrocketing rents, stagnant wages. At this point, no wages for many residents in Chelsea. And currently residents cope with these conditions by doubling or tripling up of families in single family homes and experiencing many of the conditions that Gladys and Tom have described. And people in these overcrowded and substandard conditions are more likely to experience a whole range of poor health conditions, food insecurity, psychological stress. And these factors also make mitigating their risk from COVID-19 more challenging because they may have limited access to bathroom facilities or hygiene or control over their environments to protect themselves from COVID-19. And so I think looking forward in terms of longer term solutions, we need to be thinking about ways we can reduce overcrowding for vulnerable populations. And that means increasing access to affordable quality housing in the city, which is really the foundation for so much of health and opportunity. And also be thinking about the wave of coming evictions once the moratorium on evictions ends, when people haven't been able to make rent over the last several months.
Thanks for that, Catherine. Listeners, we want to invite you to join this conversation for the rest of the hour. Are you living in a community with high infection rates and systemic disenfranchisement or high housing rates, gentrification? Are you someone who doesn't and are concerned that this Commonwealth needs to give more resources and more support to communities that are experiencing this massive challenge? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom, what is the greatest pain point for you in your work right now? And what single thing would most help?
So right at the moment, I think our focus has been twofold, at least for the last 2 weeks. One is just ensuring that we can ramp up food production. And we've gotten, I'm very grateful to the Baker administration. We've gotten some helpful assistance from them in terms of ramping up our ability to distribute food in the city. So right now we have the National Guard here 5 days a week. They're rotating at two distribution sites. We're ramping up to distribute at those two sites and through home deliveries up to 1,500 boxes a day, 6 days a week. So each box feeds a family of two for 7 days. So the goal is to be able to feed 18,000 people here a week. That's about 40% of our population. But even in the best of times, 60% of our population is food insecure. So even then, we're not meeting the need. But that's really one pain point. And the second pain point right now is rental assistance. As we said, lots of people who are not making any income whatsoever, May 1st is rent day, they are not in position to pay their rent, so we are working hard to figure out ways to assist them in being able to make this rent payment. And it's true, and we're very grateful to the legislature that they've passed this moratorium. But the moratorium doesn't stop the obligation to pay rent. It just means that the ability to evict people for non-payment of rent is being deferred. And we're very concerned that once that moratorium lifts, there will be lots of evictions unless we can figure out a way to get people money to pay rent. If I had one need, I would say the need is more money, more support for food distribution programs, more financial support for rental assistance. Those are the two pain points right now.
And Gladys, we have been hearing so much at the state level over the last several days about the importance of testing in terms of our ability to help put people back to work, allow more freedom of movement, remove social distancing guidelines, giving people more flexibility in their lives, which of course is part of what we need for problem solving. Is the Chelsea Collaborative doing anything around testing, and how would you sort of rate or describe the state of healthcare and testing in your community?
So I would say that that in terms of testing, I feel more comfortable in the past 2 weeks that situation has been a little bit addressed since the governor and our city manager have come to this agreement that testing was required, that we're waiting for some type of public health guidelines that we're not allowing to test as many people as possible. But since we have that, I feel more comfortable that we're getting the testing that is needed. Although I really think that, you know, the numbers are not telling the true story. If it was up to me, I would probably think that, you know, we don't have 1,000 100 and plus cases, that probably we have close to 3,000, 4,000 people with COVID-19. Because at the beginning, many people were being sent home with the symptoms without being tested, and they were in quarantine. But they were also in the food line. While they were told to stay home, they were in the food line looking for support and looking for whatever relief that we were able to give them. When it comes to the whole rental situation, I really hope that we would have some type of rental amnesty where we can, because we know that many renters will not be able to pay back the rent that is owed during the COVID-19 crisis. We ask also that that we have mandated a right to counsel eviction proceedings and increase the funding for civil legal aid. Because, for example, I have called, like probably in the last 10 days, I probably had conversations with 20 landlords. The people in line, they give me the phone, can you call my landlord? He's kicking me out. And I'm like, there's a housing monitoring. And immediately what they said when I called them, the landlord says, I don't care that it's a housing monitoring. Tell the judge that if he pays my mortgage, then he can tell me what to do. In the meantime, if she doesn't pay, she's going to get evicted. Noria Elise was my housing person. She probably has 900 people that by May 1st, they're being threatened to be evicted. We just hired a lawyer to come on board and help us address that issue. So that's why we are asking also from the Governor Baker administration to do an executive order to sort of like increase funding for legal defense, legal aid.
Because people thank you for that, I'm sorry, Gladys, we just, the clock is telling us it's time to wrap up.
Don't worry about it.
I appreciate that. That's Gladys Vega, Executive Director of the Chelsea Collaborative. Thank you. And Tom Ambrosino, City Manager of Chelsea. Tom, thanks. Catherine Robb, Postdoctoral Research Fellow with the Bloomberg Harvard City Leadership Initiative at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As of last week, the community of Chelsea had an infection rate 6 times the statewide average. So we are spending this hour talking to people in the community there. Do you live in Chelsea or in another community with high infection rates in Massachusetts? Are you concerned with the disproportionate impact the coronavirus is having on different communities? Do you have thoughts about how we should be helping our communities respond when they are disproportionately hit by this virus? We want to hear from you at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We want to bring in two more voices for this last part of the show. Roy Avellaneda is the president of the Chelsea City Council, who's been helping coordinate food distribution in the community. Welcome, counselor.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Maria Belen Power, who is the associate executive director of Green Roots, an environmental justice organization. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Roy, you're working at the food bank today in Chelsea, which is based out of the Chelsea Collaborative. We heard from the Chelsea Collaborative in the previous segment. Initially, this food bank was based out of your coffee shop, but the need was too great. What is it like there supporting people with food?
Well, it's overpowering, and then it's at times very overwhelming, too, to see the line that we had, and as you stated that earlier, this all it started at my coffee shop. I was assisting Gladys in this pop-up. We saw that there was not enough going on in the food pantries that the city had already had in place, that is common in many poor neighborhoods, and that there was a void and a dramatic increase in need. So when we started this, it was very surprising and overwhelming to see the lines form and try to keep up with the demand. And as you mentioned, as this got rolling and bigger and bigger, and thankfully, from the donations of, other stakeholders in the area through our contacts, we were able to increase the amount of boxes of food that we were donating. We had to move to a bigger location because just a little coffee shop couldn't handle the amount of food and space and volunteers, quite frankly, to be able to manage. So we're doing over between 500 to 1,000 boxes a day, two times a week.
Maria Belen, I hesitate. I'm trying to figure out how to ask you this question without sounding almost flip. I don't mean to. Did the community see this coming as infection rates began in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Yeah, it's an interesting, as you said, an interesting question, because we would have never expected to be hit by a pandemic like this or by a virus like this. Our work is at the intersection of race, class, and environmental justice. So we've always thought about the next crisis being an environmental one, a climate one. We see climate change, and we see the work that's happening in municipalities around us. And so that was the expectation. And I don't think anybody would have ever imagined this. However, the way COVID-19 has exposed the inequities and the way it has played out, it has been very similar to the way climate change, the way we expect climate change to impact our communities, low-income communities, communities of color, and communities who are language isolated, who don't speak English as their first language. I think there's a couple ways in which that has happened. One is, there's a big denial of the science at the climate change conversations. And so there is also a denial of the crisis of COVID-19. But then also we understand the virus to be impacting these vulnerable communities in a much deeper way. And the same can be said about climate change and the climate crisis. Our communities, not more prone to being infected to the virus. I remember hearing Dr. Fauci saying, it's not that African-Americans are more prone. It's that our communities of color, have a much harder time bouncing back, recovering. Our pre-existing conditions, our environmental injustices, our race and class are all factors that contribute to our inability to recover the same way other communities that are wealthier, white communities that benefit in many different ways are recovering.
So let me give Roy just a chance to kind of riff on that or respond to that based on what you just heard, Roy.
Well, we've had a lot of time to try to analyze the why a community like Chelsea was hit harder than others. And the we keep on going back to several things. One, social economic factors, which was the 80% of our population here in Chelsea work in the service industry and are deemed part of the essential workforce. So this was a group that continues to work right now or had to work for a longer period of time and didn't have the ability to socially distance themselves as part of the job, didn't have the ability to, say, work from home. And that's 80% of our population. We also have a high dependency on public transportation and communal transportation. What I mean by that is not only were we packing ourselves on the 111 bus or the Soda Line and the MBTA system, but there are a close to 10 plus work temp agencies in the city of Chelsea that come here because we have that segment of society that would get and work for our temp agency and get on a van. So we have a lot of individuals here who every morning get on a work van with 10 plus, and they would go on the van. So you have all this transportation going on that expose them for a longer period of time. And lastly, but then you also have the part of the housing. Our housing stock is all multifamily, mostly multifamily. We're not spread out like the suburbs. You don't have a ranch house on a 7,500 square foot lot, and you can separate. You don't have cul-de-sacs in the city of Chelsea like you see in other communities that can separate themselves and not be. We have many common hallways, doorways, and such that the ability to separate yourself from other families and individuals is not real. It's not realistic. So you also have the economic portion of it all that we did not have in place. And we're not the fact that we may have rent assistance or a moratorium on evictions. We did not know that they, maybe this the National Guard was going to come in through to assist all these pantries and the pop-ups so that they didn't have to worry and work for a long period of time and say, okay, I know my family's going to be taken care of. So all of these things led up to the fact that we were going to be infected because we were going to be exposed at multiple places.
So I want to bring in a call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We had a call from Kieran in Dorchester. He was happy to just have me place the call. Ask the question. Kieran's asking, Kieran, and I'm glad you called. Kieran is asking, what concrete ways can we help the people in Chelsea? So I'll ask you, Maria, first. For other communities who want to show up for the community of Chelsea, want to be helpful right now, what can they do?
Yeah, there's a few ways that I think people can contribute. I think that the first part that I'll say is that the role that Chelsea plays for the entire region is one that is often not understood. And so we know that 100% of the jet fuel that's used at Logan International Airport is stored on the banks of the Chelsea Creek. We have 70 to 80% of the region's home heating fuel. We have 400,000 tons of road salt that serve over 350 communities. And we have
Are you saying that the road salt is also stored in Chelsea? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. It's also
stored.
Sorry
to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, it's also stored on the banks of the Chelsea Creek. And we also have one of the largest produce distribution centers in the country. So if you think about the impact and the role that Chelsea plays for the region, not just the essential employees, but the entire community plays an essential role. So anybody that has home heating fuel, anybody that eats fresh produce, anybody that flies in and out of Logan, anybody that uses road salt on their streets, we are all benefiting. But yet it's the people who live in Chelsea, low-income folks, low-income residents, residents of color, residents whose language is primarily not English. Those are the folks that have to live with this environmental burden. And so and that has obviously played a role in the impact that COVID-19 has had on our residents. I think there are very concrete ways that folks can help. One is the One Chelsea Fund. We created this fund in collaboration with the city and other nonprofits like the Neighborhood Developers, the Chelsea Collaborative, along with Green Roots. And all of that money is going directly in cash assistance to families in need. We are distributing checks every week, and folks need it badly. Folks need money in their pockets. They need money to pay for basic necessities that they have not been able to. So the One Chelsea Fund is housed at the United Way, and it is being distributed in checks by these three organizations to residents who are most in need. I think the other piece that I will say is advocacy. We have been pushing for environmental justice legislation for years, and our state has not enacted it. And if there isn't a time more urgent than now to protect environmental justice communities, I don't know when it's going to be. The definition of an environmental justice community has three criteria: race, income, and language. And those very same criteria are the factors that have determined which communities are being disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. So if there isn't a more urgent time for our legislature to pass environmental justice legislation than now, I truly don't know when it will be. There are two bills.
So Maria Belen.
Yes.
So I'm just going to stop you there because a couple other subjects I know that I want to get to, and we have limited time now. So sorry for interrupting you there. In addition to environmental justice, Roy, I'll turn to you on this. There's also, we've heard a lot of fear in the community from undocumented individuals who may be delaying or not seeking aid. Have you seen that fear there? And how should we think about documentation immigration policy in the time of this coronavirus pandemic as well?
I, one of the things that we're doing with the One Fund plus the City of Chelsea, we are going to transfer monies from the Community Preservation Act over to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund so that we can assist those individuals that with the rent payments that do not qualify for the $1,200 check and so forth. We need to have a real conversation about members of the community who, while they may not be documented as being illegally, are loyal taxpayers for their work. They go out and to show that they're a good moral standing on picking up the TIN numbers and tax identification numbers and say, well, maybe the next time that there's assistance and we're in this situation, we don't look negatively to those who have TIN numbers and are paying taxes but are not citizens, are not unqualified to receive assistance. And to what Maria Balam said earlier about, you know, spreading the weight of, say, housing and such. Chelsea, we passed the Community Preservation Act. We have a 20% inclusionary zoning. You got to think of what housing is as a state. And the next time these communities out there and abroad across the Commonwealth, when they're trying to fight a 10% inclusionary zoning on these housing projects that will get into their own communities, they should think twice, because this is what it happens. This is the impact it has when you jam too many people together because housing is unaffordable and other communities don't want to bear the cost or the weight of being fair. One community, one little community can't do everything. And that's just been the story of the Chelsea. It's, you know, it's just for what we are as a size, we carry way too much of a burden to support the economy of the rest of the state.
So we have a little less than a minute left with the two of you, and I just very briefly want to ask each of you, where are you drawing hope and inspiration right now? Maria Belen, just briefly. Go ahead, Roy.
No, again, I think that we all see what's going on the streets, and that's our inspiration. We get the calls for people who are in need. They are our friends, their family, their friends or friends of family of someone that we do know or a small community, and that's the inspiration. It's been a roller coaster of a ride these last 4 weeks and doing the work that I've been doing, and also in the calls that I'm involved with my colleagues and other stakeholders. I think that we just dig down a little deeper and say that there are people that are in need and need our help, and it just inspires us to keep on going.
And Maria Belen, can you give me just 10 seconds for you? I'm against the clock on the show.
I would say that where I draw my inspiration is the immense collaboration that there has been in the city. Organizations working together, residents working together. Yes. And I think that neighbors working together and the response, I truly believe.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I thought we had more time, but we don't. And I got to wrap us here. I'm so sorry. That's Maria Belen Power and Roy Avellaneda, both from Chelsea. Thanks so much.